Session 7, School, Your Child's World of Work. Like you, your child goes to work each day, copes with others, and brings unfinished projects home each night. In this session, Betty and Brian will look at the special skills to help your child succeed in his life as a student and in his workplace of the future.
Brian, in the last session, we've been talking about creating opportunities for connecting with your child. And in this session, we're going to be talking about your child's world of work. And that's certainly an area where we connect also. I know I see so oftentimes when I move around the country and work in the schools that parents will participate in their child's life when he's little. But as the years go by, they slowly drop the participation in the school. And it's an important point because, you know, in all the effective schools research, the highest correlation between a child succeeding in school and in life is the correlation between the parent being there for the child, seeing that the world of work is a valuable one.
Yes, some of the research on inner city school districts, including one in Harlem recently, where they got the parents, 70% of whom were welfare mothers, to get completely involved in the educational system, they found that they had academic achievement that exceeded that of any other nearby district. And the one single factor was that the parents went continually to the schools and interacted with the teachers and sat in on the classes and then helped their children and encouraged their children to do homework. And many of these were unmarried teenage mothers.
Right. I like the correlation of looking at a child's schoolwork as his school place, or as I call it, his job. And you and I as parents go to work every day, and so do our children. And that's an important point because parents have to look at the seriousness of that. Sometimes parents say to me, what does this kid have to worry about? I mean, he gets up every day and, you know, I pay the rent and he has a little breakfast and he goes to school and he gets to hang out there. I have to go to work. But in fact, the child's school is his workplace, Brian, and we have to understand that he needs a number of skills to manage his day-by-day life there and is often frustrated there if we don't help.
Yes, and I don't think a lot of parents really, really realize how terribly important the child's world of work is to every single dimension of their life, not only as children but as adults. A recent Time and Motion study concluded that the average adult worker in America couldn't do a full day's work if their life depended upon it. And they said, why should this be so? Why is it that the Japanese and the Germans are doing so much better than us industrially and economically? What they concluded was that our children are not taught to work at home. That if a child's work habits are not pretty well formed by the time they're 10 or 12, they're unlikely ever to develop. So what you have is you're turning out generation after generation of teenagers who cannot work. They cannot do a full day's work. And boy, does this ever hurt them.
It really does. If we look at what the nature of work is, the workplace, there are basically three facets, Brian. There is the relationships we deal with every day, people at work. There, of course, is our immediate job, the tasks that we do. And then, of course, the skills we bring to it. And that is exactly what parents are dealing with children. And that is the tasks that need to be done in order to make it through school. And he deals with other children all day long, and teachers and administrators, a number of relationships. And also, he needs a set of skills to get by with his day-by-day work in managing it.
You've heard the old saying that success breeds success, or there's nothing that succeeds like success. The opposite is true. Failure breeds failure. If a young person is not taught how to study by their parents, and it's very doubtful that teachers have the time or inclination to do this, if a young person isn't taught to study, they're going to do less well than their peers at school. Therefore, their self-esteem in comparing themselves with their peers is going to be lower. If their self-esteem is lower, their ability to do their homework and their schoolwork is going to go down, which is going to lower their results, which is going to lower their self-esteem. So there's a direct connection between how effective a child is in doing their schoolwork and getting acceptable grades and their level of self-esteem and the level of effectiveness with everybody else.
Yes, and you know, Brian, you've been talking right now about self-esteem, and a child who feels capable, a child who feels like he can manage his day-by-day school activities, gets a good sense of feeling capable, which in fact empowers his self-esteem. And it's likely to set in motion what we call a success cycle. We say success breeds success. And that's a powerful reason for parents to help put in place the skills that will allow children to be successful in their workplace.
Yes, and we talked about self-esteem, that it is performance-based, that children only have a sense of self-esteem to the degree to which they feel mastery over the critical areas of their life. Well, this brings us to Leon Festinger's theory on social comparison, where he said that we do not compare ourselves to an absolute standard, like from A, B, C, D, E. What we do is we compare ourselves to what other people like us are doing. So young people are continually comparing themselves in every detail to how well their peers are doing, and then adjusting their self-esteem and self-image upward or downward by how positively or negatively they compare to the accomplishments of their peers.
You know, Brian, I think it would be really helpful here if we would talk about some of the things that parents can do specifically to help their child in their world of work, because it's more than just homework, helping children in homework, although homework is very important. But when we work with parents around the nation, we look at six key factors. And the first of that is to help prepare your child for the job. And what that really means is that as a parent, you're saying to your child, homework is an important link to what happens during the day. And so a parent finds a place in the house. Some parents don't have a study room for the child. You know, there may not be enough room in the child's bedroom. Some children room with other children, younger children, and it's not conducive to doing homework. But if a parent knows that there has to be some area in the house that's associated daily with doing quiet homework there, another facet of that is to have good lighting.
And it's important, exactly what you said, is that whatever the parent emphasizes and repeats over and over again, the child is going to consider important. So in homes that are turning out highly productive young people, parents are continually talking about homework and how important the homework is, and do you have any homework tonight, and what is your homework, and let me take a look at your homework, and can I help you with the homework, and so on. If parents think that the schools are going to take care of this, they're asking the schools to do too much.
Well, you know, schools right across America are saying that every child should have between 30 and 50 minutes of homework nightly. If your child doesn't have homework, you need to check with the school again, because teachers are being asked to link up with homework and to also link up with parents. But right along with that, Brian, and I know you do it in your home place, you provide a consistent atmosphere for homework. At my house, what I do is, and I've done it for years and it's been very effective for my daughter, is that between 5 and 7 o'clock, nothing occurs but homework. There are no incoming telephone calls. We actually unplug the phone between 5 and 7. There is no television. There is no pop music, no hard rock music being played. It is a time associated with productive homework. And if it happens to be that she has no homework during that particular evening, if it's a night before finals or a night before a holiday or something, there's those same regulations still apply, and she simply will sit down and read or find quiet time for herself.
Yes, in the studies on homes that produce highly effective young people with regard to work habits, they found an interesting distinction between homes that turned out low producers. It was with regard to where homework was done. They found in the families that produced high performers, the family dinner table was the homework table, and that when the dinner was cleared away, the homework came out, and no television went on, no music, and the children did their homework in the presence of their parents. The parents may have read, the parents may have talked, the parents may have done the dishes, but the parents were there, and the children did their homework at the family dinner table. So it just became a ritual. You clear the table, you bring out the homework books, and you do the homework. In the homes that produced low achievers, what they found was that children were sent to their bedrooms to do the homework. And that reminds me of that Uncle Remus story where Br'er Rabbit says, "Please don't throw me in that briar patch. Whatever you do, please don't throw me in that briar patch." My children begged to be punished by being sent to their bedrooms.
And because so what, that was a pretty exciting place.
Yes, that's where they have all their toys and all their books and all their fun and sometimes access to telephones. So what we find is that children need to do their homework in public and be watched and be monitored, but not in a negative way, not in a demanding way, not in a hostile way, but in a positive, supportive, helpful, caring, but emphatic way.
You know, one of the things I do still, Brian, is if I have work that I have to finish up for the next day, I will sit down at the table with my daughter. And so while I'm being productive, she is too, and she's getting the message over and over that it's a time to be productive. And the second area is to help your child get organized. And this is such an important one for children because, you know, kids bring home in their backpacks so many things. They say, well, I have a spelling test tomorrow. I've got four math problems. I've got the science fair project due in 3 months. I have this to do and that to do. I think I'll watch television, mostly because they don't know how to organize that. Where do they begin to prioritize that?
You know, I've done a lot of work in time management, and the time management skills that work for adults certainly work for children. The starting point is to encourage your children to take the time to make a list of everything they have to do, and then help them to walk through the list and say, all right, what's the most important thing that has to be done tomorrow? What's the second most important thing? What has to be done the day after tomorrow? What has to be done later on in the week? So you start with a list, you set priorities on the list, and then you say, if you could only do one thing on the list, which one should it be? And the child will always say, well, this is the most important, because if I don't do this, I'm really going to be in trouble. Then you say, all right, let's take this and take all the books away that do not refer to this, and have the child sit at the table and work just on that one project, and then establish a reward. And then say, as soon as you finish this, you can do this. You can watch some television, have a cookie, go for a walk, play with something, make a phone call. In other words, create a reward for completing each part of the homework assignment. And it's amazing how motivational that is.
It is important, Brian. One of the things we find with children is that because they are very visual, they need a concept of space, time and space. And so parents find it very helpful to just take a very large wall calendar. It doesn't matter whether your child is 5 or 17. Take a very large wall calendar and log in the events of what's going on in the school. If the semester ends here, put that in. If the science fair project is due 3 months from now, put that in and break it down into manageable goals. What's due next Wednesday? What's due Friday? And so on. And that's a very powerful tool for helping children get organized. And also, Brian, it keeps them from getting discouraged. Sometimes children are overwhelmed. You know, as children get older, they have 5 and 6 and 7 teachers, each teacher creating demands of their own. Children don't know where to begin if they come home overwhelmed with work. And it's a way to help children, again, prioritize.
Yes.
A third area, Brian, is to show a real active interest in your child's homework. And not only homework, but in the school as an important function. You know, we've been saying that a parent's association with school, saying school is purposeful, is a powerful link to whether children will want to achieve there. And a very powerful way to show an active interest is to question your child. Rather than saying, how was your day? And they say, you know, fine. What did you do today? Nothing. Say, what did you learn today? Or ask the questions that draw your child out.
Yes, and have your child teach you is a good thing. Have the child teach you what they learned. Have the child walk you through what they learned step by step. Children will always tend to dismiss you at first. When you say, what did you learn today? They say, oh, nothing, or not much, and they'll drop the subject. But instead, you insist. You say, no, tell me, what did you learn? What did you learn this morning? What did you do this afternoon? What did you bring home? Can you show it to me? And start to pry it out of them. For parents who work hard, this seems to be a difficult challenge, because when a parent gets home at night, the parent wants to take it easy too. The parent is tired. The parent needs to unwind and relax. But I'll promise you this, a most wonderful thing happens. The more you force yourself to become involved and interested in your children's schoolwork, the more you actually will become fascinated by what they're doing. You'll actually find yourself reading their books. You'll find yourself interested in their homework. You'll find yourself more and more curious. One of the most wonderful aspects of psychology is that we act ourselves into feeling. And if we pretend or get interested in our children's schoolwork, in a very short period of time, we actually find ourselves very interested in it, which is wonderful for our children.
And we've been saying throughout this program that it's important, because we're busy and because children's lives are busy and we live in such a rapidly changing society, that we need to look for as many ways as possible to be active in our children's lives, because it shows them that we are looking to be connected, that we care. Brian, you know, another way to be very involved in our child's world of work is to meet our child's boss. And as children get older, that means sometimes meeting 6 or 7 bosses, and it's an important concept.
When your children know that you know their teachers personally, and you've told the teachers, please feel free to call me at any time, and you've conveyed to their teachers that you're really, really interested and involved in their child's education, the teachers take special attention with your children in school. They will have a tendency to take far more attention with your children than they will spend with the children of parents who never show up or go to PTA meetings or never talk to them. So a very important point is to keep that link up. So when your child looks up and sees his or her teacher, they know that teacher knows you, and their tendency to bring their homework home and do it is far, far greater.
Right. You're setting up responsible behavior again. You're also doing something else that's very powerful here, Brian, and that is that students who have a very high relationship with the teacher do better. When children know that you know me, you care, they are more likely to turn out better work because they know it's going to be read. They know it's going to have personalization to it. There's a very high correlation there to children achieving.
Right. Now, where do you start this? My feeling is that you have to start getting involved in your children's education at about kindergarten, and then first grade, and then second grade, and then third grade, and that you have to maintain it all the way through. I've spoken to many parents who say, well, yes, when my children get into junior high school and high school, then I'll get more involved. But the fact is, if you do not get involved at an early age, it's often far too late to get involved later.
Yes, well, you know, Brian, the research that just was published last month showed that of the students who drop out of high school, nearly 90%, I believe it's something like 87, 88%, said that no one cared about them. They didn't feel the teacher knew them personally. They didn't believe their parent cared about them personally. In other words, the relationship of the child succeeding in the school place, in the workplace, was related to how connected he felt to parents and to teachers.
Yes, and parents have to realize that they have a tremendous responsibility here, that one of the jobs of the parent is to be responsible for teaching the child. It's possible to delegate part of that responsibility to the school system, but as we know, the school system is not doing a great job in that area. Nonetheless, the accountability, the final responsibility for the success of your child's education still stays with the parent. The parent is a teacher. By having children, you have taken on the responsibility of being that child's teacher, counselor, mentor, and trainer for the course of his or her formative years.
You know, Brian, years ago I was a school administrator, and one of the things we used to say to parents is, do you know what options your child has here in the workplace? And we would design a little workbook to say to parents, please use our school as though it were a grocery store. Shop for your child. Do you know that your child can be very accomplished in, you know, these three or four activities? I mean, he literally can take photos and be a very accomplished photographer. Do you know that he has the skills or the options to gain the skills here to take his car apart and put it together? He could build a house from scratch up. He can learn four languages here. He can learn, you know, we went on and on and on. And we were saying to parents, do you understand the options your child has here? Please participate enough to encourage your child to participate in the options that the school has available.
You know, everything that you've said up to now, Betty, causes me to see this problem or this whole situation from the opposite side. What we're saying is that it's the parent's active involvement in education that determines whether or not their child is a successful learner. But the opposite side of that is that the major obstacle to children being successful learners, enjoying the high self-esteem that comes from academic accomplishment, learning good work habits that will serve them all their lives in the world of work, going on to good schools, being in good social circles, associating and playing with other intelligent children, being respected by their teachers, all of the obstacles to that are in solely parental involvement or lack of parental involvement. That if parents become actively involved in the education of their children, they assure, if not guarantee, their children that whole list of advantages that we just talked about. But if they don't become actively involved and stay actively involved right through high school, their children haven't got a snowball's chance in you-know-where. Isn't that true?
That's true, Brian. You know, teachers say it this way. They say, at elementary, we see most all of the parents. At junior high, we see only the parents whose children are doing very, very well. In the high school, we see only the parents of the children who are truly excelling. In other words, there is a correlation between the parent showing up and the parent not showing up and that child who succeeds and that child who does not succeed. You're right. It's a very powerful correlation.
What is it that Woody Allen said, that 80% of success is just showing up? It may be that 80% of your child's academic success is just the parent staying involved, showing up at PTA meetings, showing up to meet with the teacher, showing up at the table to discuss what the child is doing in terms of their homework.
That's right, Brian. You know, I side with the parents here, too, because like our listeners, I'm a parent of a child, and my child is a teenager. And my child is in her fourth year of math, and I don't have the math skills that my daughter has. My daughter is in her fourth year of language. I mean, my daughter has gone beyond the skills that I have in foreign language and so on. So it's not always possible for me to participate actively in helping her answer the questions in her homework that she doesn't have. But that doesn't mean that my attitude can't remain the same. I am there. I am willing to go for external sources of help if I need to. I am willing to support her and encourage her in areas where she has to apply extra attention or extra care in order to get it. Homework isn't easy. I mean, school isn't easy. School is not a bowl of cherries. It's hard work for children. School is hard work even for gifted children. And so, again, what we're really saying here is that active parent involvement shows our children that school is purposeful, and that link will help children stay with something even when it gets difficult, even when it gets hard.
The marvelous experience of Marva Collins, the black teacher in Chicago, where she took inner city school children who had never done particularly well and started teaching them in her apartment with schoolwork and school books that she had found in garbage cans, and started to bring them up to very high levels of academic accomplishment, proved conclusively that it is the attitude of the teacher, it's the attitude of the important person in the child's life toward what they're learning that makes education fun. And we know that the parents' attitude toward the homework and toward the schoolwork of their children can have a tremendous effect on their intelligence. Some of the tests show that intelligence is malleable. IQ is malleable across 10, 20, 25 IQ points, whereas a child that may seem to be slow under the consistent and persistent encouragement of a positive parent that believes in the child and works with the child and helps the child, the child's intelligence can actually grow measurably, so much so that a child who could barely get out of high school may qualify to go to a good college or university solely as the result of the influence of the parent that works with them continually year after year.
Yes, you know, I always find very fascinating the ideas of working with children, both gifted and, you know, at the other end of the scale, children who are either learning disabled or even retarded. There's a child who is a mongoloid child, and this child is just wonderful. He's exceeded in social skills. He's exceeded in reading skills. He's exceeded in skills beyond what we typically think about for a mongoloid child. And part of that comes from, no, I would have to say, Brian, the majority of it comes from the stimulation that he had from both parents and their willingness to treat him like a child capable of succeeding. In other words, the standards and the expectations that they set for that child were very high. And like a self-fulfilling prophecy, he rose to those expectations.
In the last century, and even 50 years ago, Betty, when a young man or young woman reached the age of 9 or 10 or 11 or 12, they would be apprenticed out to a craftsman. If they came from a working home, they'd be apprenticed out to a carpenter or a shoemaker or a dressmaker or a seamstress. And there they would work under the careful guidance of a master craftsman for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, and they would learn their craft, and then they would go off and they would be set for life with a skill. And they would get a journeyman's ticket, if you like, or a certificate of competence. Parents have to see themselves as being in that position with regard to training their children in work habits from the time their children go to school for the first time. If they'll work with them for the first 1 to 7 years, maybe 1 to 8 years, and lock in those work habits so the child really knows how to do their homework, a remarkable thing happens. First of all, the child's level of competence in the first, second, and third grade, how well they do their schoolwork, is going to determine their attitude toward education for the rest of their life. Their attitude toward education is going to determine how high they rise, what kind of schools they graduate from. It's going to determine the people and the kids they associate with, whether they're winners or losers. It's going to determine how much money they earn, the kind of husband or wife they marry, the home they live in. It's going to determine what happens to their children and their children's children. And it all comes back to the parents' involvement in those formative years with regard to schoolwork.
Yes, and you know, Brian, we've been talking about helping children become happy and healthy and highly esteemed. And an important part of that as it relates to the world of school, Brian, is to help children feel a purpose of what they're doing in school. Working for grades is not that big a reward. Children who, in fact, get good grades are rarely motivated by good grades. They're motivated to do well. They're motivated by excitement. They're motivated by the expectations of parents and meeting that. What happens is they begin to see a purpose to what's going on. And parents who are successful in helping their child succeed in school have linked up helping their children feel purposeful. In other words, they've given their children experiences where they say, oh, I can see why this is important. You know, we say that boys select their careers in eighth grade, and that by ninth grade, girls have selected their careers. Well, if we look at those children who have, in fact, selected careers so young and early, we see that it is because parents have exposed them to a number of things and have helped them clarify, would this be exciting for you? You know, is this something that you have an interest in? So children, again, in their schoolwork are seeing that school amounts to something. They see a point to it.
They call this reading on purpose or studying on purpose or doing schoolwork on purpose toward a predetermined goal. One of the things that Dr. David McClelland of Harvard found was the importance of what he called the reference group. He said that 99% of your success or failure in life is going to be determined by the people with whom you habitually associate with. In other words, if you associate with the leaders in school, you're going to consider them to be your reference group, and you're going to do and walk and talk and act and think like them. You're going to take on their values. You're going to accept their standards. You're going to set their grades as your standard or your objective. If you have a reference group of losers or medium achievers or low achievers or dropouts, you're going to behave like them. And when you give your children the gift of learning, when you show them how to study, when you stay with them until it locks in, if you like, so they can get the kind of grades they want, you virtually assure that their reference group of peers is going to be a higher caliber of people. They're going to be young people that come from better families with better values, young people who are going to make something of their life earlier rather than taking the chance that they're going to end up associating with those who are going nowhere.
Yeah, Brian, you know, that is the sixth area, and that is that parents who have children who succeed in school look at how their children are adjusting to what we call peers. We don't call them friends because friends and peers are completely different. Peers are the group of people that are in your class. Peers are the group of people who are in your school. Good friends are something different. That's a very personal nature. But we know that the school place, because relationships are what happens thereafter, skills and the tasks of the job, we as parents have to ask, how are you doing? And so one important area is seeing that our children have the socialization skills, Brian, to manage the conflicts that children encounter. You know, we know that sixth and ninth grade children in particular have a great deal of difficulty sifting in friendships. A sixth grade child, whether it be a boy or a girl, one of the most important things that occur there is making and keeping and sustaining a friendship. So if you get on the school bus and your best friend hasn't saved a seat for you, we're talking forget the day. No other learning is going to occur because you're so emotionally out there. And so an important part of school too, Brian, because there are so many children in classes and so many children in the school place, the workplace, is to know how your children are faring, know how they are adjusting. And one of the best ways you do that is by keeping a link to your child's teachers. And you keep a link to your counselor or your principal. You want to know how your child is faring overall in the regular socialization and know that this transfers again in the workplace, in his skills in later life.
This brings us to a question that many people listening to this tape are asking. What if you've dropped the ball? What if your child is having problems in school? Your child is having difficulty reading, having difficulty adding and subtracting and dividing and doing trigonometry? What if your child has poor work habits and is demoralized and is frustrated and is unhappy and so on? Well, there is fortunately a solution. The first solution is to get in with both hands and both feet. Give yourself dedicate at least a year, depending upon how old your child is, maybe more than that. But say for the next year, I am going to work hand in hand with my child to get my child good, solid school work habits and to get my child the remedial education necessary to catch up with his or her class. Again, as we said earlier, that if a child is falling behind his or her peers or friends in education, their self-esteem suffers immeasurably. So therefore, if you can bring the child back up even or even slightly ahead of their peers, their self-esteem will go through the roof. My child, Michael, was having problems reading that we didn't realize a year ago. His teacher, and we'd gotten very involved with the school, his teacher called us one day and said, could we come in after school and talk? So we came in, and the teacher, in a very, very uneasy way, because she felt uncomfortable about it, she said, there's a problem here. Michael should be doing better with his letters and with reading than he is. And I suggest that you get some help. And we asked her what kind of help. And she said, well, there's a good child psychologist who will test him to find out if he has a learning disability. So we took Michael to the child psychologist. The psychologist tested him out completely and concluded that he had problems with reading, that he needed some very, very intense hands-on tutoring. So we took this back to the teacher and we said, what do you suggest we do? The teacher said, go to a remedial education organization, an outside commercial company that specializes just in bringing children up who are having troubles with reading or math. And we followed her advice. And Michael went to this course for about 8 months, and he went twice a week, and he got a lot of education, and his reading got a little bit better, and we worked with him, and we worked with him at home, and we went to his class, and I watched him, and I finally started encouraging him, because he hated reading. He felt that it was a real burden. I finally started encouraging him by creating a new reference group for him, and I said, Michael, you are a leader, and you know something? All leaders are readers. All leaders are readers. And I kept repeating that. You're a leader, and all readers are leaders. In the next 2 months, his teachers told me he took off. In the next 2 months, he caught up on 2 full years of reading. The next 2 months, he just made quantum leaps ahead. But what happened to his personality and his self-esteem has been wonderful. The one area, whenever it came up, that started to make him feel uneasy and uncomfortable and angry was his schoolwork. Now when his schoolwork comes up, he pulls out tests that he's taken recently where he's gotten 100% in spelling, 100% in reading, 100% in definitions of words. And he is so proud and so happy. So my recommendation is that if your children are having difficulties, pay the price, make the sacrifice, get them some instruction, get them tutoring, get them remedial education, give them whatever they need to get up even with their peers so that they can go on to great successes in the rest of their lives.
Session 8, How to Raise High Achievers. Getting your child to set high standards and expectations for himself isn't just a matter of IQ or luck. In this session, Betty and Brian share the parenting characteristics that can produce high achievers.
In this session, we're going to talk about how to raise high achievers. I think one of the things that every parent dreams of is that their child is going to turn out to be a star, that the child is going to go on to accomplish something significant and worthwhile in life. In fact, I remember reading a story many years ago about a man who became very successful as an adult, and the only advice he could remember his father ever having given him was, "Son, I expect you to do something worthwhile with your life." And he said that was his guide, that was his guiding value, is that everything he did, he tried to fulfill his father's request that he do something worthwhile with his life. And so what we want to talk about in this session are some of the things that a parent can do to assure that their children will have the greatest possible chance at achieving their full potential in the world of work.
You know, Brian, the first step, and I think our listeners are going to go, oh no, here it comes again, is that old unconditional love.
Absolutely. When children feel completely loved by their parents, they feel free to try. In fact, the true measure of how secure an environment you've created for a child is how free the child feels to take risks and to risk the possibility of failure and falling on their face and not feeling that it will threaten their sense of self-worth.
Right, because they have nothing to lose. They know that if they shouldn't succeed, at least on the first try, they still have their parents to rely on. They still are loved.
Yes, and we know that the greatest single obstacle to success in adult life is the fear of failure. It's also the greatest single obstacle to success as a child. So create an environment where failure is not fatal, where a child feels that they can take risks and fall down and pick themselves up and carry on and still maintain the esteem and respect of their parents is absolutely critical to eliminating that fear of failure that stands between the young person and the success that's possible for them.
Right. Setting an expectation of going forward where they're not afraid of fear is important. You know, we see this every day in the school environment. We see kids take, I'm going to be funny here, but it's like study hall one, study hall two, shop three, shop four. We see students so afraid to take an advanced course because they might get a lower grade in it, they might get a B or a C. We see this effect set in, Brian, where children don't risk failure because it's a negative.
A very successful young man who was the president of a $500 million company told me once that the one piece of advice he can remember his father giving him, and he grew up on a farm, he said, "My father always told me that there's nothing that you boys can't do. He would never allow us to say, 'I can't,' when we were growing up. He would always repeat over and over that there's nothing that you can't do if you really put your mind to it." He said, that has been my guiding principle. At the age of 33, he was the president of a $500 million company. He said, "I've never felt since then that there was anything I couldn't do if I really put my mind to it." In other words, what his father did was created in him the belief that he did not have to be afraid of failing.
So setting expectations is the second and very powerful step in helping children be high achievers.
Yes. Well, you know, Thomas J. Watson Sr., the president of IBM Corporation, founder of IBM, was once asked by a young man, "How can I be successful faster?" And he gave this wonderful piece of advice. He said, "Young man," he said, "if you want to be successful faster," he said, "double your failure rate." He said, "Success lies on the far side of failure." Double your failure rate, that success lies on the far side of failure.
Right. Well, you know, I'm reminded of the Thomas Edison story. You know, Edison didn't invent the light bulb overnight. And in fact, in his attempt to discover it, failed thousands of times. An apprentice said to him, "Why don't you stop? I mean, you failed so many times." And he said, "Young man, I have not failed. I have successfully learned 1,000 ways that do not work."
Yes, and we're going to come to that as part of Raising High Achievers later, that particular attitude towards success versus failure. And that's a very, very important point. You'll find that successful parents are those who help their children look upon every stumble as a learning experience, not a failure. They never criticize their children for having made a mistake when they've tried to do something. There's a wonderful story of the fellow who comes down the street as the bus is pulling away from the bus stop, and he's carrying his briefcase, and he starts running, and the bus starts going faster and faster, and he starts running faster and faster, and he's far too far behind, and the bus picks up speed and is gone. And he finally stops running, and he's panting, he's out of breath, and he walks back to the bus stop, and there's this other guy standing on the bus stop watching him. And as he gets back to the bus stop, he says, "You know," he said, "you never had a chance to catch that bus." And the man replied, he said, "Yes," he said, "I know I missed the bus." He said, "But at least I missed it trying."
That's right.
And that's the critical thing. You want your children to, if they're going to miss the bus, you want your children to miss the bus trying. And you're the one who creates the psychological environment where the child feels free to do that.
That's right. In Gail Shee's excellent book, Pathfinders, where she highlights the 10 characteristics of people who move on and go on in life creatively. And the third hallmark, Brian, was that people in all cases had made a major mistake or a failure. But what they said was, "What I learned from that was." In other words, they were able to erase that from the error column and chalk it up into a positive experience. People with low self-esteem didn't do that. Yeah. They said that it was a very detrimental life experience and a very negative one, and it caused them to go into a tailspin where they just found themselves in a rut. They were unable to go forward.
Let's talk about some of the research that's been done on high achievers. One of the most important pieces of work that has been written in the last 50 years, in my estimation, is a book by Dr. David McClelland of Harvard called The Achieving Society. And what he did, and this is very relevant to what is going on in America today, what he did is he studied societies over the centuries, and he looked at the factors that caused them to be successful economically. And he came up with some very interesting conclusions. One was that the heroes of a society at any given age or stage of its development determine what young people will try to be. In the 1980s, for instance, the heroes of America have been entrepreneurs and business people. They've been written up in all the magazines, they've been in all the newspapers, they've been in all the television programs. So what you find is if you interview young people today coming out of high school or university and you ask them, what do you want to do with your life, 50, 60, 70% of them aspire to being entrepreneurs and business people, to starting their own enterprises, to building companies, to taking charge of their lives in the commercial world. And this is consistent with what has gone on for centuries. So the starting point of achievement for a young person is who are the heroes of the young person.
And I don't want us to miss that point because it's so critical. Oftentimes parents feel that children develop heroes and who knows who those might be. But what parents need to know is that they can affect who those heroes are, that parents have a big part in helping children align with those heroes.
Yes, there's a wonderful series of books for young people that were written by Dr. Spencer Johnson, and they're called The Value Tales, and they're for children up to the age of even 10 or 12 years. And what they are is a series of values which are told through the biography of men and women who represent those values. For instance, the biography of Benjamin Franklin will represent persistence, and the biography of Marie Curie will represent industriousness, and the biography of Albert Schweitzer will represent love or compassion. And reading these type of stories to young people causes them to identify and create heroes or heroines of men and women who have done wonderful things with their lives at an early age. That stops them from setting up as heroes people who are rock stars or people who are sports stars, people who are, if you like, in the limelight for a short period of time and gone, but encourages them to choose heroes that have really done something worthwhile over a course of many years.
Yeah, it's really important. I see a deterioration of our reading lists in schools that were once very rich in biographies of heroes that were worthwhile, who stood for purposeful goals, Brian, now being replaced with a lot of pop books.
And one of the things that you can ask an adult is, who are your heroes? What people living and dead do you admire? What qualities of men and women living or dead do you admire the most, or do you respect, or do you wish to be like? Because the parent's choice of heroes or heroines is very important to children. If a parent believes that George Washington was a terrific person, or believes that Mother Teresa is a wonderful person, or that Florence Nightingale, or that Albert Schweitzer were wonderful people, and they read about them and they teach their children about them, children are far more likely to set these people as the kind of models that they pattern their lives after than if they don't.
You know, I think about our book, Achievement, Happiness, Popularity, and Success, the esteem book for children, and it was for teenagers. And in the back of that book, Brian, remember we asked teens to write back and feed us back response. And the response that we got most was that teens said, and those who were successful in school, said that their favorite hero, their, you know, favorite person was their parent, and they could tell why. And children who weren't aspiring couldn't identify who their heroes were, or if they were, they were a culture, you know, a current rock culture person, a star, so to speak.
And do you know why it is that children will describe their parent as their hero? It's because their parent is their primary source of encouragement to achievement. Is they look upon the parent as being the person in their lives who gives them the encouragement necessary to keep on trying in the face of all the challenges that young people face.
Right, to go forward in an optimistic way.
Yes. The studies on leadership are really interesting because what they find is that men and women who become leaders early in life are invariably those who in their formative years read a lot of biographies. They find that they were very interested in reading the stories of other men and women and how they had overcome adversity and how they had achieved positions of respect and renown. Whereas people who do not become leaders are those who do not read biographies in their formative years, and therefore they have no reference points or no framework to think in.
Another very positive correlation for high-achieving children are parents who set goals for children and teach children the framework to set goals.
Yes. A very important part of high achievement, according to McClellan's work, is the setting of goals and the systematic accomplishment of them. Another thing he found, though, is that they looked at homes that produced men and women, or boys and girls, who became high achievers early in life. What they found was that the homes that produced high-achieving young people, the mother was a critical factor in this sense. is that the mother would, when the child was old enough and was age appropriate, as they say, the mother would give the child a responsibility, a job that became that child's job. Because of the child's nature, the child would do it once or twice and then try to delegate it back to the mother by saying, I'm too tired, I'm too small, I can't do it, and so on. In the homes that produced high-achieving young people, the mother refused to take the job back once it had been delegated. They made clear to the child, this is now your responsibility. You own this job. So the child would do the job, even though the child didn't want to do the job. The child would do the job and by so doing get a feeling of success and pride and achievement that caused them to want to do it again.
So we might say responsibility is a key one. You know, Stanford did a what they called a 40-year study, Brian, and they took delinquents. They studied delinquents over a 40-year period of time, and they wanted to know what were the key factors in turning around these children's lives and making them purposeful and able to be a part of society and relationships and so on that work. And what was the hallmark? And they call their study high life satisfaction. In other words, they wanted to know what can produce high life satisfaction. And they found that responsibility was the key ingredient. And these children had learned that responsibility primarily from being a caretaker. In other words, they had a responsible role. They had to be responsible for someone. And the overall was that, Brian, it related to these individuals after 40 years were more likely to say that they really enjoyed their job. In other words, job satisfaction was high. The second thing was they said that they really enjoyed their marriage. They experienced high degree in their marriage relationship. And the third was they said they really enjoyed their children. And the fourth and last area was they said, I'm happy. And so life satisfaction, of course, is a real key element. We all want our children to experience overall satisfaction. And responsibility was the key in this.
So it comes back to the parent has made the child responsible and then not allowed the child to evade the responsibility until it locked in as a quality in the child. Now, that's interesting because the study I was just quoting found that the families that produced low achievers were families where the mother or father had given the child responsibilities. And when the child had delegated the responsibilities back, the parent had made excuses for the child and taken the responsibilities back, and the child was off the hook. And what happened was the irresponsible behavior, the I'm not responsible, the I can get out of it, the I don't have to do it if I don't want to attitude was reinforced in the child, and the child became an underachiever as a result.
Yeah. Brian, I'd like to come back and expand a little bit on the goals idea, because so oftentimes parents think that they can't help children set goals until they're older. And an important part is to set a success cycle very early. I'm reminded of some of the things that I teach parents for elementary children, and that is to set what we call a wish list. And so when a child is very young, you might put up a big tag board in the room and you call it a wish list. And you, of course, are monitoring it. You want your child to have some wishes going on. One, that they get, you know, have some friends. Secondly, that there's a focus on relationships and it might be family fun and whatever those are. But you set in front of the child a visual image for some things that he wants to achieve, and you make sure that's a very visual one. When children get older, you set that into goals. During this month, these two or three things will occur. And so parents can set that goal cycle in motion when children are quite young.
You know, it has been well said with regard to that, Betty, that the kindest thing that a man can do for his children is to love their mother. And I'm sure that the reciprocal is also true. With regard to goals, the kindest thing that a parent can do for their child is to be a goal-oriented person yourself, which is to have a very clear set of specific goals and action plans for their accomplishment, which means to get a spiral notebook, to get a pad of paper, and sit down and think through where you want to go and what you want to do and what you want to be in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. Children can sense through the skin if their parent is goal-oriented. And the very fact that you are working systematically and progressively toward goals of your own makes it far more likely that you can teach and encourage your children to work toward goals of their own.
And, of course, your own attitude is showing, too. If you're setting goals, chances are you're achieving goals. And achievement leads to a feeling of self-worth and your overall feelings of well-being, and you're more satisfied with life, and you turn around and you set more goals. Children sense that, and pretty soon they're actively involved in it.
Well, and the fact of the matter is that if you believe that it is good for your children to have goals in order to train them in the skill of achievement, if you believe that's true and you set it as a value, it means that you will do it yourself. It is only your actions that are indicative of your true beliefs. You cannot say, son, daughter, you should have goals if you want to become everything you're capable of becoming, but I don't happen to have any myself,
right,
because children can sense that hypocrisy in a moment.
Right, and you know, we've been talking about the attributes of self-esteem, and when it comes down to those final components, helping children feel worthwhile, helping them achieve, helping them get a sense of purpose. Goal setting is the way to begin some things in motion where they're getting a sense of accomplishing, where they're getting a sense of achievement.
In our course, The Psychology of Achievement, we talk about goal setting at great length, but the conclusion that I've come to in 25 years of research into human performance is that goal setting is the master skill of success. That if a parent wanted to assure their child's success more than anything else, they could send them to the best college and set them up with a trust fund of millions of dollars and teach them self-discipline and self-responsibility, or they can sit down at the kitchen table with them and systematically and progressively over the course of their developing years train them to be excellent goal setters. I've said, and it was written up in a major article in a national newspaper, that those who do not have goals are doomed forever to work for those who do. If you want to raise leaders, the kindest, the most important thing that you can do is to train them in goal setting, and the only way you can train them is to train yourself and then share the information with them.
And this really relates to high achievers, Brian, and coming back again to raising children's own sense of self-esteem. The whole idea of achieving is to give children a sense of feeling capable. And children who feel capable feel competent, Brian. And feeling competent lends itself to feeling worthwhile, and that's an important part of self-esteem.
They call this self-efficacy. They say it's linked to self-esteem in that self-efficacy is the feeling that the child or the adult has that I can do it, that I have the capacity, I have the ability to accomplish this goal that I've set for myself. And then that feeling is what generates self-esteem. Self-esteem is performance-based. Self-esteem, real lasting self-esteem, if you like, the big log that burns on the fire as opposed to throwing gasoline on the fire, deep lasting self-esteem only comes about when the child knows that I can do it because he or she has done it. And that's why it's so important that parents help children set realistic and worthwhile goals, that they help them set goals that are within their grasp, that they're capable of accomplishing. A child may say that I want to go to Harvard University, or I want to have a car, I want something else. The parent can help the child scale the goal down into bite-sized pieces and then help the child focus on one piece at a time. And by so doing, the child builds up a sense of momentum that makes it possible for them to accomplish ever greater things.
Right. Well, they say, you know, that goals must have at least a 50% chance of achievability. If we don't do that, Brian, we set in motion for children a defeatist kind of attitude, because they have to be able to see some success in doing something in order for them to want to go forward on it.
Yes, and little successes build up the strength and the power for big successes. I'm working on a project now that's based on some work done by a management consultant named Robert Schaefer called the Breakthrough Strategy. And it's very interesting. What he says is that instead of trying to change the whole company or the whole organization, focus on single, discrete, measurable projects that you can start on now with the existing resources that you have this moment, that don't require approvals or extra resources or different levels of authority. And I think that's perfectly applicable to raising high-achieving young people, and especially to raising self-esteem in young people, is to get your children working on very small, discrete tasks that they can do now, whether it's cleaning up their room now, or helping clear off the table now, or doing one homework assignment now. When children get the sense of achievement because they have accomplished it now, they're far more likely to persist, they're far more likely to get tremendous feelings of self-esteem and self-efficacy than if they take on too big a goal that takes too long to accomplish.
You know, Brian, we've been talking about children really competing with themselves, and that's an important part of this, because we want children at some point to be self-reinforcing, to compete with themselves, to set their own expectations and standards and not necessarily set themselves up in relationship to other people.
Yes, Peter Drucker commented many years ago on the brain drain. And when many of the top scientists and technicians and engineers were coming over from Europe to America in the 50s and 60s, and they were interviewed and they were asked, why are you coming here? Is it so you can make more money? And almost invariably they replied, no, the reason we're coming here is because there's more opportunity for us to achieve in our field here than there. So they studied this and they stretched it out and they found that the thrill of achievement is the greatest single motivator in the world of work, is that it's what you might call a positive addiction, is that once a person has had their first great achievement, nothing else will ever give them that kind of satisfaction except achieving something more and better. The point that I'm making is this, is they looked at all the young people who didn't seem to be going anywhere, who were drifting in their late teens and their 20s, and they found one common factor is that they had never been given an opportunity to achieve something worthwhile. In other words, they'd never been able to enjoy that sensation of having overcome difficulties and struggled and worked through and earned a meaningful success, and as a result, they were just drifting. It's almost as if they didn't know that achievement was out there because they'd never been exposed to it.
You know, Brian, I keep coming back to parents, and that is when I work with parents, I ask them what they think the correlation is between their child achieving and being a good achiever, what they think their link in that is. And parents who do help their children achieve have thought about not only their own can-do attitude, but also setting the skills in motion for children to do that. And one of the primary skills is exposing children to some things. You can't just expect your child at some point find something that he's excited about. While that might happen, successful parents expose children to a number of things so they can begin to find, what is it that I'm about? What do I want to do? When children want to do something, they're more likely to go forward in it.
Yes, and what happens when a child tries something new for the first time is they initially embark on it with a lot of enthusiasm. At a certain point, they lose enthusiasm because they have not achieved a success in it, so they don't have anything to hook into. At this point, what the parents of high achievers do is they move in with support. It's like they bring up the reserves. They move in with support and they encourage the child to persist. They encourage the child gently. They encourage the child positively. They encourage the child by helping the child. But they encourage the child to persist long enough until the child wins. You see, the feeling of winning is the critical feeling that causes a person, a young person, like a guided missile, to lock on to the target of achievement. The sooner that a young person can get their feeling of winning, the more likely it is that they will persist and continue to greater and greater victories.
Right. You know, in the school environment, what we do is we ask teachers to help children identify two or three areas that they feel very, very competent at. And do you know that most kids can't name those, Brian? We ask a child, what do you do really, really well? And you see, what happens over the years is children get so many check marks and not enough goal stars. And I always say to parents, what goal stars are you giving your children? Because those goal stars show children to move forward and to keep accepting. But we find that children stop achieving over the years if, in fact, they haven't had lots of positive reinforcement from teachers and parents.
Just the day before yesterday, Christina was struggling with something, and I forget what it was, but my instinct was to go and help her and do it for her. And as I got up and I started moving toward her, I had to sort of grab a hold of myself and stop. Even though I knew that I could do it in a few seconds, what might take her a few minutes, I knew that the only way that a child experiences this sense of self-efficacy that leads to self-esteem is if they struggle with something and do it themselves. Remember the commercial that said, I would rather do it myself? Then that was a really good line. The fact is that young people, even with the best intentions on the part of their parents, need to do it themselves. When we talked about achievement a second ago, and young people who grow up with no sense of achievement, what we found was that they had made a decision, their parents had made a decision, that their children aren't going to struggle the way I struggled. So what their parents did is they protected their children from the struggle. They moved in. They took the responsibility away. They moved in with the money. They moved in with the help. So their children never had to go it alone. Their children never had to, the expression is, duke it out by themselves. Because when the critical moment came, they could turn to their parents and the parents said, I'll take care of it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because so many parents say, I don't want my daughter to have to struggle like I did through college, and they're talking about paying for it or something, or they provide their child with a car automatically at age 16 without the child being a part of working and earning and supporting the car. And in fact, they're really hindering their children from further achievement.
Yes. One of my favorite expressions was an expression that was on one of the tapestries, I think it was the Bayreuth tapestry. It said, the north wind made the Vikings. That expression is true in raising children. I sat down with a very successful businessman about 2 years ago, and he was talking about a manager that he was working with who who was interviewing a very, very good-looking candidate for a job. The man came from Harvard. He had a three-piece suit. He had a gold watch fob. He was beautifully groomed and dressed. And the manager was interviewing him for a job in sales, in professional selling. And at the end of the interview, and the fellow wanted the job, at the end of the interview, the manager thanked him very much for coming and declined to hire him. So this friend of mine who was watching this took him aside and said, "Why didn't you hire that guy? That guy looks great. He's beautifully dressed. I mean, he'd just make a tremendously positive impression of our company." And the manager turned around, he said, and said something to me that I never forgot. He said, "This man has not learned to overcome." He said, "This man has had everything given to him all his life, but he has never had to face adversity and struggle and overcome difficulty to achieve something worthwhile. And therefore, we could hire him and he would look beautiful, but he would fail abysmally in a field that required tremendous persistence in the face of difficulty."
You know, there's a saying that I'm seeing around a lot these days in a poster that says, "From our greatest failure comes our greatest success." In other words, we excel in areas that we did have to really struggle at and work at. I also remind parents quite a bit, Brian, while they want their child to struggle and to learn and to go it alone, to, again, set realistic expectations, because I do see a lot of children who have given up, children who have burned out because they've not had enough support from parents. And I think the message here is to set realistic expectations, to set goals that are attainable and not out of reach of children. Otherwise, children will give up.
Here's an important point. We talk about what is necessary to develop the achievement mentality in young people, and we know it's goals, and we know it's self-responsibility. The child has to believe that I'm responsible for achieving this. Not only I can, but it's up to me to do it. The third part is the success experiences that we talked about. In other words, the child has to have some taste of success in order to keep going, but following that, the child has to have recognition. The child has to get feedback that, yes, you did it. It's like applause from the crowd. And I look upon this as the child is on the playing field and the parent is in the bleachers. And the parent can cheer and can applaud and can praise the child and can shout at the child, "Go for it," and then can stand up and applaud when the child does well. But the parent doesn't go onto the field and play the game. They have to let the child play the game. And the parent stands on the sidelines and shouts the encouragement.
Yeah, this is what I call the gold star theory. I always say to parents, are you giving your children enough gold stars? In schools, when we want to encourage children, we put a gold star on their paper. They may have missed one or two or three or whatever, but we still put a star. In other words, we are encouraging. We are saying this is good work. And parents, too, have to be aware that gold stars are needed. And we have to ask ourselves, are we providing the gold stars our children need in order to be high achievers?
And here's another good point with regard to gold stars and rewards, is that if a child is trying to do something, for instance, like get good grades for the year, what you do is you don't give them one reward at the end of the year because they got good grades. You give them little rewards at every single step toward a good grade. Every single time they stumble forward and they achieve something worthwhile, you make a thing of it. You give them a little reward. You recognize them. You have a cake at dinner time. You take them out for a hamburger. You go for a walk. You take them to a movie. It doesn't have to be anything, but it's got to be something symbolic that recognizes small efforts as well as great achievements.
I agree, Brian. You can do this very effectively in children, too, by commenting about your children, praising your children in the presence of others. I sometimes do that. In fact, I try to do that quite often, and I know you do that very well with your children. But if Jennifer's in the office, I will talk about some of her successes, even in areas where she has really, truly struggled to achieve something. And I'll talk about it in front of someone else, and it's just like an eye-opener to her.
Well, Michael comes home from his remedial reading classes with his certificates of accomplishment. And every single time he does, I stop everything that I'm doing. It's beautiful little certificates with ribbons and everything else. And I go and get Barbara, and I pick him up, and I hug him, and I carry him around, and I treat him as though he has just conquered Rome with his legions. And I do this, and it reinforces it, and he goes back and does it again and again and again, because we make something important out of his triumphs. And children need that more than they need the triumph.
It's such a simple concept, isn't it, Brian, of saying that one very important way of helping our children achieve and want to go forward is to recognize them and as though they're important and worthwhile and worth it all.
And it's like a Pavlovian response in a way. You remember the experiments of Ivan Pavlov? They would feed a dog a piece of meat and ring a bell, feed a dog a piece of meat and ring a bell. Each time the dog saw the meat, the dog would salivate and hear the bell at the same time. After they had done this enough times, they could just simply ring the bell and the dog would salivate. What you're doing with your children in a way is, in a very healthy way, is you are programming or conditioning them so that every time they achieve something worthwhile, you praise them and encourage them and make them feel good about themselves. Pretty soon, the very thought of achieving something worthwhile in their minds causes them to feel good and excited and worthwhile. And that's what gives them the strength to persist, the strength to overcome, the strength to struggle through to success, is the very thought of achieving the goal gives them such a feeling of self-esteem and excitement that they have been conditioned at what is called a positive addiction. They become addicted to accomplishing worthwhile things because they feel so good about themselves as a result.
Right, and that's usually what creates what we call internally motivated a student. One of the great struggles that the schools are having in the country right now is how to keep children motivated, how to keep them from becoming apathetic and so on. And part of it is just for us as parents to set in motion a success cycle when children are small so that when they are in junior high and high school, they begin to be self-reinforcing. They begin to start motivating internally because they're working toward achievement, Brian.
Yes, well, if you can imagine that your number one source of motivation for a child when they're young is you. It's an external source. But if you keep encouraging them and motivating them in a positive and constructive way, the source moves like on a straight line from you to them. And at a certain point, the source of motivation becomes internal. It locks into the child. So from then on, they become self-monitoring, self-regulating, self-organizing, is that they motivate themselves by setting goals and working progressively toward
them. I just came back from a workshop, Brian, that I did for parents and teens in Montana. And I said to the mother, we were talking about when did they notice that their child just became self-achieving, self-monitoring, just really going in a positive direction. And she said, I'm not sure what the event was, but it was right around eighth grade. And so I turned to her son and I said, do you remember that time? And he said, oh, yes. He said, my mother and I were on our way to a soccer practice. And he said, there was this white cat, and he stopped and described this cat. And this, by the way, this boy is now a senior. And he described this cat right to the T. And he said, I said to Mom, can we take this cat to the vet? And he said, my mother stopped, and we took the cat to the vet. Well, the cat was hurt. And they patched up the cat, and they took the cat home. And he put the cat in his room, and he said to me at that time, he said, my mother paid this bill. He said, we didn't know whose cat this was. It wasn't a cat we'd recognize in the neighborhood. He said, but we took the cat home, and he said, I went in my room, closed the door, and I cried, and I couldn't figure out why I was crying. He said, and then I realized it was because I felt so good. So I went down the street, hung up a sign, if you lost your cat, call this number. And he said, on the way back to the house, I decided right then and there I was going to be a veterinarian. And I said to him, did you ever waver in that? And he looked at me without stopping. He said, absolutely not. So I turned to his mother and I said, because sometimes, talking with parents and teens, you're talking different languages. And I said to his mother, did he ever waver? And she said, oh, yes. She said, when he was a second semester junior, his 11th grade year, she said he didn't know whether he wanted to be a large animal vet or a small animal vet. She said, but what I remember most is that from that day forward, that child was self-motivating. She said, this child was reluctant. She said, I'd have to encourage him to go to soccer. She said, some days I'd have to talk him into going to school. She said, from that day forward, he was an achiever. She said, he had a purpose. He had found a mission. He was an achiever. He was different.
That's great. We should wrap up this session on how to raise high self-achievers with two really important points, or perhaps three. The first of the three is that helping your children deal with the inevitable failure and disappointment is an important role of parenting. And the way that you do it is simply by focusing the child on the learning experience, just as you were saying a little bit earlier. When a child has not succeeded at something, stop and say, all right, what did you learn that'll make you better next time? How would you do it differently next time? what are the valuable lessons that we can get from this? And the more the child starts talking about what they've learned from the experience, the more the experience takes on a totally positive glow in the child's mind, and the fear of failure or associating the experience with failure disappears.
Right, erasing it from the error column and putting it into the what I learned from that was.
Exactly. And the second thing that you do is to remember that working with your children, encouraging them, pushing them, supporting them to complete their tasks is an act of great kindness and love for a parent, because successful task completion generates a feeling of self-esteem and self-worth. Whereas if a child does a task 95% but doesn't complete it, they get nothing from it. When I encourage my children to clean up their floor so that a mouse could run across it, and they clean it up and there's not a single speck on that floor, they just beam with pride and self-esteem because they've completed the task and it's obvious that the task is complete. So helping your children push through to that last detail of the task is a real act of love that a parent can perform.
And to not let up when your children get older. You know, in an earlier session in helping your child in his world of work, we talked about how some parents back off a little bit when their children get older. This is important for children all the way through high school.
Yes, and the last point I think that's important is, I love that Beatles song, Help, I Need Somebody, Help, I Need Someone. The fact is, be willing to step in and help your children work toward task completion. Not to do it for them, not to relieve them of the responsibility, but actually to be working for them, if you like, as a resource to them, and be willing to help so that your children know that they've got you behind them. But in many cases, they'll say, Daddy or Mommy, I can do it myself. Just knowing that you're there to help gives them the strength to carry on and do it themselves.
I agree, Brian. The underlying role here is that if we can set this cycle of high achieving in motion when our children are young, Brian, it carries through in our world of work, in later life, and so on. It lends itself to high satisfaction in life.
Yes, and it's never too late. Some of the highest achieving adults were complete washouts as young people. Some of the most successful entrepreneurs were complete disasters in school. Some of the greatest statesmen and stateswomen were people who had terrible times in their earlier formative years. But the one thing that they remember is that they had a parent who continually encouraged them to give it their very best and to strive for excellence.